Well, turn with me to the passage that we read a few moments ago in Mark's Gospel and chapter 15. Mark chapter 15, we read from verse 33. Our focus this morning is going to be on the two first verses of that section of Mark's Gospel, the chapter of Mark's Gospel, verses 33 and 34. I mentioned last night that over the three services, what I want to try and do is share with you what I'm calling three portraits of Jesus. Last night we were thinking about what we described as a certain Jesus, a Jesus marked by certainty as he approached his death, as he made his way from the Passover meal to Gethsemane and spoke to his disciples. This morning we're going to be considering forsaken Jesus. And then this evening, God willing, we'll be considering a satisfied Jesus. But this morning, as we consider the passage before us, this is the portrait of Jesus that we'll be thinking about that is presented to us in these verses, a forsaken Jesus. A cry in the dark. These very words evoke a haunting and perplexing image. A cry in the dark. Who is the unfortunate from whose lips the cry is heard? Is the cry heard at all? Is that not the tragedy of a cry in the dark? Though some may hear, few are listening, and fewer still care or understand. Now in our passage we have recorded for us the most haunting cry in the dark that human history has ever witnessed. Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, my God, why have you forsaken me? Are you listening to that cry? Do you understand this cry? Now let's be clear. It would be foolish presumption to claim any kind of exhaustive understanding of these very deep and solemn words. And the reality that provokes them is also a reality that we will ever find difficult to fully understand. Nonetheless, the words are recorded for our instruction. And we are encouraged and challenged to try and understand this cry in the dark, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. We need to listen carefully as these very words this morning echo through the centuries and clamour for our attention. Now we're going to focus our exclusive attention on these words of Jesus uttered as he was soon to breathe his last. And the manner in which we will consider this cry in the dark is to begin by describing the cry and then attempt to explain the cry. So these really are the two parts, if you wish, to the sermon. The cry described and the cry explained, at least in some measure. So first of all, let's think about the cry described. What did Jesus cry out? I think we can describe the cry from a number of angles. We can think about and notice the moment of the cry. We can comment on the intensity of the cry. The object of the cry, to whom is the cry directed, and also the words themselves. And all of this simply describing the cry. So these are the different angles from which we're going to be tackling this part of the message, the cry described. First of all then, the moment of the cry. We're told in our text in verse 33, at the sixth hour, darkness came over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out. So there, very clearly, we are given the moment of the cry. We're told then in verse 33 that at the sixth hour, darkness came over the whole land until the ninth hour. Now, Mark does not tell us the impact of the darkness that descended at midday and enveloped Jerusalem and Judea and who knows, perhaps beyond. We can only try and imagine the drama of the moment, and I would encourage you to do that even now. Just imagine the drama at midday. When the sun is at its highest, suddenly darkness descends upon the land. It is a dramatic moment by any measure. On a hill overlooking Jerusalem, midday becomes midnight. Now, different natural phenomena have been proposed to explain a daylight transforming into darkness. But it's difficult to escape the simple conclusion that God simply switched off the lights. Now, how that happens, I can't explain to you. But that seems to me a reasonable conclusion to come to. In the very words of Luke, in a parallel account, Luke speaks of this moment in this way. The sun's light failed. And it's a moment of great drama. The moment of the cry. And the lights remain resolutely off for 3 long hours. We're not told, but we can imagine that the scene at Calvary changed in the midst of the darkness. The cruel mocking subsided. I would imagine the very drama, the very darkness would have quietened the mocking voices, I would presume. The smug taunting is no longer heard, and we're left with impenetrable and unremitting darkness. And it is as the 3 hours are coming to their end that a cry in the dark is heard. A cry that pierces the darkness. This is the moment of the cry. But we can also move on and comment on the intensity of the cry. Mark tells us that Jesus cried out in a loud voice. He cried out in a loud voice. With this detail, I don't think Mark is principally concerned with volume, though clearly it does describe volume. But I think the loud voice speaks of a cry that is uttered by a man in control of his mental faculties. This is a conscious and a deliberate and a climactic cry on the part of Jesus. Not some cry of desperation, not the cry of a man who has lost his reason, but rather a loud, deliberate cry on the part of the one crying out. There is an intensity to it, but it is conscious and deliberate. And to whom is the cry directed? Well, again, Mark tells us, or it is clear from his account. This may be a cosmic moment, but the cry is intensely personal. It is directed by a son to his father. And yet, as we very well know, and this is often remarked upon, Jesus does not address his father as father. Now, in Mark's account of the crucifixion, he only records these words of Jesus on the cross. But we know from the parallel accounts that both before and after, on the cross, Jesus addressed God as his father. You remember the occasions. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. That is before this cry. And then subsequent to this cry, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And yet, at this point, in this cry in the dark, the paternal vocabulary is absent. And yet, even in the absence of that vocabulary, it is very clear who is being addressed. My God, my God. Why have you forsaken me? And the language retains a real measure of its intimacy. My God. We were thinking with the children about the significance of saying, the Lord is my shepherd. That's intimate language. Well, on the cross, even this cry in the dark, though the language of Father is absent, and no doubt there's a significance to that, it remains intimate. My God. My God. This is one who in the midst of the darkness, both in the firmament and in his own soul, identifies the one seated in heaven as my God. But then we have the words themselves of the cry. And I think there can be little doubt that Jesus is deliberately employing or certainly echoing the words of Psalm 22 that we sang a few moments ago at the very beginning of the psalm. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me? So far from the words of my groaning. Now in the psalm, the one pronouncing the words is the righteous sufferer. The innocent man persecuted for his faithfulness to the Lord. And Jesus, in pronouncing these words, gives expression not only to the anguish of his soul, but to the identity of his person. He is declaring, in pronouncing these words, he is declaring by this cry in the dark, I am that man. I am that righteous sufferer. This is the cry described. But there remains the much more difficult and delicate task, what does it all mean? Mark does not give us that explanation. He wants to feel Jesus' agony, not to explain it. The very darkness speaks of an episode that is shrouded in mystery. This is the realm of the inscrutable, where by its very nature that the spiritual dimension of the suffering of Jesus is largely inaccessible to us. And to a point, we thank God for that. We don't want to fully understand. To do so would be to gaze in the very face of God and to be struck down. It would be more than we could bear. And yet we must try and understand, if only in a measure. Which takes us on to the second part of what we want to think about this morning. Having considered the cry described, simply describing, drawing really from what Mark says, we move on to the second part, the cry explained. Why did Jesus cry out in this way? It's maybe obvious, but it's worth noting that what we're trying to do is answer the very question posed by Jesus. That was his concern in posing the question, my God, why have you forsaken me? And what we want to do is answer that question. Why is this happening? Why is Jesus forsaken there on the cross? The words of the African-American spiritual serve to paraphrase the haunting cry of Jesus. Lord, how come me here? Lord, how come me here? How come indeed? What is Jesus doing on that God-forsaken cross? What is going on that he would be there of all places? Lord, how come me here? My God, why have you forsaken me? And we can tiptoe solemnly into the deep waters of explanation with the aid of a couple of questions as we try and grapple with this matter. And the first question, it's really a preliminary question, but perhaps a helpful one just to pose and to deal with. And the first one is it true? That seems a very bold question to ask. Is it true? And I'm not asking whether it's true whether Jesus announced or pronounced these words. We're taking that as a given, that he did indeed cry out in this way. But when I ask the question, is it true? I'm asking the question, is it true that Jesus was forsaken by God, as the question would seem to presume? Now, different answers are given to that question. And answers given to the question that maintain the authenticity of the record, that Jesus did indeed pose the question. And I think we can boil down the two answers that are given to the question to these. There are those who would argue that, yes, Jesus cried out those words. He posed the question. But the reason he did so is because he felt forsaken. And the question gives expression to what he felt in his soul. And then the other possibility, of course, is that he was indeed forsaken, and hence the question is posed. As I say, some people argue that Jesus only felt forsaken, that Jesus was overcome by a sense of abandonment. In the midst of the darkness, this was his perception of reality. And one writer who holds this view expresses it very elegantly with these words: "There never was an utterance that reveals more amazingly the distance between feeling and fact." So claims this particular writer. And the argument goes along these lines, that Jesus' cry is, in the light of Psalm 22, that we've already indicated, Jesus is echoing the first words of that psalm. In the light of the whole of the psalm, Jesus' cry can be understood as a cry of hope and victory. And the argument is that if Jesus employs the first verse, or the beginning of the psalm, he must do so aware of how the psalm ends. And the psalm does indeed end in hope and victory. And we'll be singing the closing verses of the psalm at the end of the service. But let me just read out for you the final verses of this very psalm that Jesus makes use of, employs the words of in his cry. And the psalm ends in this way: "All the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations will bow down before him. For dominion belongs to the Lord, and he rules over the nations. Posterity will serve him. Future generations will be told about the Lord. They will proclaim his righteousness to a people yet unborn, for he has done it." And so the idea is that Jesus is aware of the whole psalm. And so these words, haunting though they may be, can be understood as a cry of hope and victory of one who felt abandoned by God. But insightful though some of these suggestions are, the reality is that Jesus only voices the words of forsakenness. The words of hope and victory are far from his lips. Jesus was forsaken. It seems to me that the record allows for no other alternative. The alternative smack of special pleading, driven by an understandable reluctance to accept that the Son of God could be forsaken in such a manner. And we do struggle with the question posed by Jesus: "Lord, how come me here?" But the answer is not to question the reality, but to try and understand it. And that leads us to the second and crucial question as we look to explain this cry in the dark. Why was Jesus forsaken by his Father? If that's the conclusion that we come to, and I think it's the only reasonable one we can come to, the question remains, why? Why was Jesus forsaken by his Father? I think we can try and answer this question by providing very briefly, and in a kind of sketch kind of way, a threefold description of the cross as a place of judgment, a place of separation, and a place of atonement. First of all, the cross as a place of judgment. Now in this, the sign from heaven, the darkness, and the words of Jesus are in perfect harmony. The darkness points to the judgment of God. It is the Father who decrees the darkness. It is the Father who switches off the lights. But why? Well, in the Bible, darkness is a symbol of judgment. God is light, and darkness speaks of the absence of, or perhaps more accurately, the displeasure or judgment of God. You remember the plagues in Egypt. In chapter 10 of Exodus, we have one of them described. Let me just read a couple of the verses from that account. "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Stretch out your hand towards the sky, so that darkness will spread over Egypt, darkness that can be felt.' So Moses stretched out his hand toward the sky, and total darkness covered all Egypt for 3 days. No one could see anyone else or leave his place for 3 days, yet all the Israelites had light in the places where they lived." In Egypt, the darkness of judgment was felt for 3 days. And at Calvary, the darkness of judgment was felt by Jesus himself for 3 long hours. The prophet Amos would seem to be anticipating this day of judgment in his prophetic words, recorded in the 8th chapter of Amos. In that day, declares the sovereign Lord, I will make the sun go down at noon and darken the earth in broad daylight. So God is judging. There is a real sense in which at the cross we have the day of judgment brought forward in time. And the one hanging on the tree is the object of divine judgment and displeasure. And so Jesus cries, my God, why have you forsaken me? But judgment is related to curse and punishment. The judgment of God involves curse and punishment. Jesus is cursed by God. Moses, as recorded in Deuteronomy chapter 21, he makes the point eloquently, anyone who is hung on a tree is under God's curse. And of course this is picked up in the New Testament by Paul. Writing to the Galatians in chapter 3, he says of this matter, Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is everyone who is hung on a tree. And this truth is further developed with real insight and clarity by Paul in his second letter to the Corinthians. In chapter 5 and verse 21, where he declares of Jesus, God made him who had no sin to be sin for us. So Jesus is enduring the judgment of God. Jesus is cursed by God. Jesus is enduring the punishment of God. And so he cries, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. This is a place of judgment. And that understanding of what is going on gives us some insight into this cry in the dark. But it's also a place of separation. Now the separation is a necessary consequence of judgment and curse. The Father cannot behold the Son made sin. In the words of the prophet Habakkuk, your eyes are too pure to look on evil. Or in the words of the hymn that we sometimes sing, how deep the Father's love for us. And in the very first verse of that hymn, it speaks of how the Father turns his face away. It's a place of separation. We've spoken of how at the cross, the day of judgment is in a sense brought forward in time. And with this thought in mind, we recall the words Jesus anticipated would be addressed to those guilty on that day. What are we told of what will be said to those who have not repented? Away from me, you workers of iniquity. And at the cross, it's as if the Father addresses these words to his Son. Away from me. And so there is separation. And this separation carries with it pain and heartache for Father and Son. Now we're given the words of the Son that speak of his pain and heartache. We have them before us. It's in the record. My God, why have you forsaken me? And we can relate to the words in some measure. We can listen to them. We can ponder on them. So we know of the Son's pain. But we're left only to imagine the pain in the very heart of the Father. You see, though the Father necessarily turns his back away, he still hears the cry. And what unimaginable pain as these words made their way to heaven from the darkness of Calvary. The intensity of the pain endured is directly proportional to the depth of the love between Father and Son. We know that in human relationships. Just a few months ago, we had some sad news from Peru, where we used to live and where Martha is from. And the town where we lived for many years, there was a dear friend whose name is Elenit. And we heard a few months ago that she had died very suddenly of a heart attack. Now, a death in those circumstances is always tragic. There's always a sadness that accompanies such a death. But in this particular occasion, we were more struck by the tragedy of who remained. Now, Elenique had a daughter, And this daughter still is alive. Ruthie is her name. And Ruthie is a very special person with very special needs. And as a result of that, she was inseparable from her mother, Elenit. They would always be seen together. I don't think I ever saw them separately. They were always together, the mother and the daughter. Though the daughter was an adult, they were always together. And it was so evident the love that there was, the one for the other. And it was even to witness it was quite a moving sight. They loved each other so much. And so when we heard the news of the death of the mother, our immediate thought was, what about Ruthie? How must she be feeling? Because she loved her mother so much that to have to endure this separation, we almost couldn't imagine how difficult it must be, fodder indeed to this day. And maybe that very human story that I think we can relate to, or illustration, maybe it can in a small way illustrate the pain endured by father and son at or by the cross. Their love was eternal, infinite, and absolutely perfect. And so their separation was beyond, or painful beyond description. Well, maybe we should and can just leave it there. A place of judgment, a place of separation, and both of these truths shedding some light, perhaps, on this cry in the dark, my God, why have you forsaken me? But finally, the cross is also a place of atonement. This helps us answer a final question. Why was Jesus subjected to the judgment and punishment of his Father? To even state that seems such a harsh thing to claim. Why would that be? Why was Jesus made sin? We can say, well, that's what happened and hence the cry, but why? And I think the answer is to be found in two words used by Paul on the very occasion that he speaks of Jesus being made sin, and we made reference to that verse a moment ago. He was made sin for us. These two very simple words. He was made sin for us. And these two words speak of atonement. Atonement involves the reconciliation of alienated parties. The restoration of a broken relationship. It is accomplished by making amends, by blotting out offenses, by giving satisfaction for wrongs perpetrated. And God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, motivated by love in eternity, determined that the Son, Jesus, would provide, would make atonement for sinners. He would stand in the breach. He would make amends and blot out our offenses. He would give satisfaction for all the wrongs that we have perpetrated. He would satisfy the just anger of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And only He could do so. Only a man who was morally perfect would be a fit substitute for sinners. And so He became a man. And He lived a perfect life. And at the cross, offered Himself up in our place, our substitute, our atonement, our Savior. The cross is a place of atonement, and so Jesus cried, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. But also, and as we draw these threads to a close, also a place of victory. You see, the very fact that Jesus cried, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, serves as unequivocal evidence that the price of sin was paid in full. In paying the price, He secured the victory. In being forsaken, He saved us from the forsakenness that we deserve. And so, it's almost counterintuitive, but the words, my God, why have you forsaken me, do constitute a cry of victory. Or they speak of the victory that was being secured by the death that was being died. Our forsaken Jesus, forsaken in our place, forsaken that we might never be forsaken. The cry in the dark on that epic day remains a haunting cry. But it is a cry that speaks of God's deep, deep, deep love for sinners. It is a cry that speaks of Jesus' perfect and sufficient atoning death. It is a cry that echoes through the ages to assure forgiven sinners, you and me, that we will never be forsaken as Jesus was forsaken for us. And to him be the glory and the praise, time without end.